Hello and welcome to Case Dismissed, a teenager's guide to the Supreme Court. I'm Carter Higgins, and I'm so glad you decided to listen today. In today's episode, I examine the case that began to define and expand Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, Gibbons versus Ogden. But before we discuss the case, what exactly do the vague words of the Commerce Clause mean? And how has it been expanded over the years? As learned in the last episode on McCulloch versus Maryland, the newly found Union faced a plethora of economic problems due to the Articles of Confederation. The result of this was the Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution, which delegates the authority to, quote, regulate commerce with foreign nations and among several states and with Indian tribes, end quote, to Congress. Throughout the years, the court has been asked to decide if many things are considered as commerce. As you'll hear later, wheat, domestic abuse, guns, and more. This case, Gibbons versus Ogden, focuses on interstate commerce, commerce across state lines, and the Supremacy Clause. The state of New York passed a law granting Robert R. Livingston and Robert Fulton a monopoly on steamboat traffic on the Hudson Bay, quote, navigating all boats that might be propelled by steam on all waters within the territory or jurisdiction of the state, for the term of 20 years, end quote. With their monopoly, Livingston and Fulton granted Aaron Ogden permission to navigate the waters between New York and New Jersey. Ogden eventually partnered with a steamboat owner, Thomas Gibbons, though their partnership ended after 3 years, when Gibbons operated a steamboat route belonging to Ogden. Ogden filed suit against Gibbons, who already held a federal license to operate his waters, even though Ogden's was only licensed by the state. The New York State Court denied Gibbons access to the Hudson Bay and ruled against his stance that Congress regulated interstate commerce, which was present in this case, not the state's. This case of federal versus state power was eventually taken to the Supreme Court. The main constitutional questions being asked were, one, does Congress have the authority to regulate interstate navigation under the Commerce Clause? And two, does New York's law, which grants a 20-year monopoly to Robert Livingston and Robert Fulton, violate the Supremacy Clause because Thomas Gibbons held a federal license on the Hudson Bay? Writing the court's majority opinion, Chief Justice John Marshall concluded that because steamboat navigation between New York and New Jersey was a method of conducting interstate commerce, for example, passengers, Congress did, in fact, have the authority to control interstate navigation. Furthermore, Justice William Johnson concurred that the national government had the sole power to regulate interstate commerce and strike down state laws that interfered with that power. Accordingly, the court deemed the New York state law unconstitutional, upholding that the Marshall Court was one bound to the Constitution and one that favored the federal government. The main precedent set by Gibbons versus Ogden was that the national government could overturn state laws if they encroached on Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce on the basis of the Supremacy Clause. For example, with the precedent in practice, Congress could now regulate, say, the wages of factory employees in a specific state if the factory directly participated in interstate commerce, or Congress could overturn such state regulations. This precedent further created the separation between the national and state governments, thus pushing a system of dual federalism, or layer cake federalism, as seen in McCulloch versus Maryland. And the ruling in support of Givens freed all navigation of monopoly control. Furthermore, this striking down of navigational monopolies greatly facilitated the settlement of the West, proving that Gibbons versus Ogden's precedent reached much further than just the court or New York State. To talk more about the Gibbons precedent and go in depth about the case and the Commerce Clause, I invited Professor of Political Science at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia, Lauren C. Bell. Professor Bell is a former American Political Science Association Congressional Fellow on the Senate Judiciary Committee and has served as a United States Supreme Court Fellow at the United States Sentencing Commission. So my first question, it's just on the Gibbons precedent. So it's widely known that Gibbons versus Ogden started to define Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, paving the way for other Supreme Court precedents and other congressional action. So on that note, assuming Gibbons versus Ogden never happened and there were no subsequent cases like it, what do you think the United States would look like?
Okay, so thinking about your question, it's a little bit hard for me to think about it in the way that you've asked it, simply because I think it would be so unlikely that a case would never have come along like it, right? In many respects, the Gibbons v. Ogden case, in some ways it's surprising it took until 1824 mm-hmm. for it to come along, because it's so much situated at the heart of the conflict between the notion of sort of state power and what states should be permitted to do under the Constitution, and then also at sort of what is the role of this still new, but not brand new, federal government, right? So, but if I kind of go back so I guess I'll just say, to begin with, I think it's really unlikely that the courts would not have decided something similar, simply because they were already deciding about what the relationship between the states and federal government should look like. You still had a good number of people and political leaders in the states who were very hostile to the notion that the federal government should be able to really do much of anything. But if I go, like, set all that aside and say, what if Gibbons was never decided? Mm-hmm. I asked myself, well, I just picked up a package off my porch from Amazon. Mm-hmm. Would Amazon even exist, right? Would we have a need for a nationwide delivery service that now allows you to order something and get it to your door within, a matter of hours, really? Yeah. And to me, I mean, I think, what does society look like? It looks a lot, there are a lot fewer Amazons, right? There are a lot fewer interstate products, or products that are made across state lines. The products that did exist or that did have to travel through multiple states would be incredibly expensive, because every state would want to tax that product as it came through and crossed state lines. So I think, a lot of the things that we take for granted being able to do today, right? The internet, does the internet exist as anything other potentially than like a military communication tool, which is of course how it was originally conceived. Does that exist in the absence of a precedent like Gibbons that allows for the federal government, for Congress, to regulate interstate commerce? And frankly, again, it's a bit of a thought exercise, right? Because it's so hard to conceive of. But but frankly, I just think a lot of those things we take for granted in terms of how we engage with purchasing or manufacturing, those simply could not exist in the absence of a Gibbons-like precedent.
Yeah, and just to add on, however, I know, like you said, it's kind of inconceivable to see that like a case like Gibbons wouldn't happen, but assuming it didn't, I think a lot of us tend to think today, just based on more recent precedents, like, what isn't interstate commerce? And so I think if Gibbons or other cases like it did not happen, I think it would be like, what is interstate commerce?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to look at it. Mm-hmm. think it would be very clear what it, right? There would be very, very clear defined boundaries around interstate commerce.
Yeah.
Because everything that traveled across state lines would be tracked and taxed. And, you know, you think about how it works if you buy something from overseas, right? And there are customs and import duties and that package that comes from abroad enters into the system, and you can watch as it moves through a variety of different checkpoints. And I think that's exactly it. It would be so clear as to what interstate commerce was because of how carefully tracked each movement would be of whatever that good was that was crossing state lines. So yeah, I think that's a really good way to think about it.
Yeah, thanks. And my second question is kind of similar, but it's more about Marshall's actions. And so we see in McCulloch versus Maryland, Marshall redefining the necessary and proper clause, whereas in Gibbons, he is giving meaning to the among the states in the Commerce Clause. So he's clarifying that Congress could regulate commerce across state lines, but not confined to one state, which has been clarified in more recent precedents. But do you think Marshall is to blame, and not in a negative, negatively per se?
Responsible for.
Yeah.
Right.
For generously interpreting the Constitution in favor of the federal government through these decisions, McCulloch and Gibbons, or do you think other courts that followed should be held responsible for expanding congressional powers?
Can I choose both as my answer?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too.
Okay, because I was going to say, I don't know that it's either or, right?
Yeah.
I think a couple of things, right? If we go back to why Marshall is appointed by the outgoing Adams administration, it's precisely because the Federalists, who had just lost power in the election of 1800, wanted to ensure that the federal government would be treated in a more expansive way than what they were anticipating would happen under the new Jefferson administration, right? And under any judges or justices that might be appointed there. So if we think, you know, should we say that Marshall is responsible? Absolutely. And that's by design, right?
Yeah.
The Adams, you know, President Adams was not thinking like, oh, I'm going to just appoint this guy Marshall and maybe he'll, you know, be an okay guy. Like, he was selected precisely because there was an agenda. And so I think we can absolutely say, and McCulloch is a great example, right? You read the decision in McCulloch and Marshall spends like four pages on what does the word necessary mean, right? And necessary doesn't mean essential, and it doesn't even really mean is the only thing, or doesn't mean absolutely necessary. It just means helpful, or, you know, right? And he goes through this whole kind of semantic exchange. I don't think you get quite the same sort of degree of, like, I don't know, you know, I'm sort of thinking about the Shakespearean, like, methinks the lady doth pretend too much, right? Like, in McCulloch, you kind of get this, like, okay, if you got to spend that much time explaining it, maybe you're really stretching things. I don't think there was quite the same degree of debate over what does you know, commerce among the states or with the Indian tribe. There wasn't the same degree of concern or confusion, and I would sort of say, you know, it would be hard to interpret that in too many different ways. But I think absolutely we have to give Marshall credit, blame, responsibility for expanding the federal government's powers and for looking for ways to do that as he's presiding over these cases. I can't think of an example where there might be a close call and Marshall's like, oh yeah, we'll just give it to the states, right? Like, Marshall's there because he believes in a strong central federal government. I mean, to the first part of your question, absolutely. Like, let's give Marshall all credit, all blame, all responsibility. On the other hand, I also think he's not the only one responsible. And, you know, certainly if we think about commerce and what constitutes kind of interstate commerce, you made the point earlier, you said something about like, what isn't interstate commerce, right? And I start thinking like, well, apparently buying health insurance, carrying a gun in a school zone, and violence against women, right? Like, those are the three things the court has said. Because to your point, right, like, we had a period of really expansive thinking about what constituted commerce. And that line or that thread runs through, you know, not so much the Tawney Quarter, but certainly in the 20th century, when you start to get into Vinson and Warren and Berger, mm-hmm. It's not until you get to the current court, right, under Chief Justice Roberts, where you start to see a real concerted effort to rein in, well, maybe late language, right? But you start to see a concerted effort to really kind of rein in Congress on just saying like, oh yeah, that's commerce, because people might want to buy something while they're doing this thing that's not commercial at all. So I think it's really both, right? I think Marshall sets us on that path, but that's a convenient way for the Congress and for the courts to justify any number of actions over the course of American history.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I was going to say both also, because, you know, because,
okay.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, it's not too hard to, you know, he's just clarifying the phrase among the states. I mean, it's not really widely interpreted, but and so I think it's like Marshall's actions can be seen as, you know, like a catalyst for these decisions. Like you said, you know, in United States versus Lopez, 1993, you know, guns were being debated as interstate commerce. So I think it definitely serves as a catalyst for these more recent decisions.
Well, I think also the court more recently is kind of, if we go back to kind of like, what is the heart of Givens? Because we haven't really even talked about what the dispute is, right? But mm-hmm. but at issue in Givens, you've got Aaron Ogden, who's operating his steamboat, and he's got a New York vessel's license. And then you've got Thomas Givens, and they were originally business partners. Yeah. They have a falling out. So Givens is kind of like, I'm getting my own license. And he goes to the federal government and he asks for a federal coasting license. Mm-hmm. Right. So now they've got these dueling steamships. They're both operating on the same waterways. Right. Ogden's got his New York state license. Givens has his federal license. And ultimately, New York seizes Givens' boat and says, you don't have a right to do this because you don't have a state license. And that's what precipitates this dispute, right? This claim between them.
Yeah.
And so it's not hard to think about why we'd want a definitive answer to that question, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we need an answer as to whether states can just start taking boats that are in federal waters, yeah, or in interstate waters, right? And so, you know, even there, I think where might want to get into some of the semantics would be, and Marshall does in the case, you know, is ferrying passengers engaging mm-hmm. in commerce, right? Yeah. So it's not so much the among the states, I think, where there's a bit of stretch, because it's not hard to get, you know, that, like, if you're going between New York and New Jersey, that's among the states,
yeah,
right? But maybe where the stretch is and where you've got Marshall sort of trying to justify that is in saying, like, yeah, they're not really moving goods. They're not engaging in traditional commerce, or what mm-hmm. we think of commerce, but they're engaging in activity that is like commerce enough.
Yeah.
And so that brings me back to your point where you say Marshall kind of opens the door,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that's exactly right. You know, it does open the door to say, let's think about what is commerce in a broad way.
Yeah.
Right? And then that sort of begets this whole lineage of cases, right? Like, I'm not sure whether this is one of the cases you're looking at, but you get to the 1940s and you get to Wickard v. Filburn,
uh-huh.
right? Where, you know, you've got this farmer who's growing wheat and he grows a little extra for himself.
Yeah.
And he gets the full wrath of the federal government coming down on him because he's, you know, disrupting the flow of interstate commerce by growing wheat for his own personal use.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see, like, that's the stretch. Is growing wheat for your own use actually commerce? If you don't actually sell it, are you engaging in commerce? Oh, well, the court says, sure you are, because you're not buying the wheat then in the open market if you've grown it yourself.
Uh-huh.
So you've got Marshall opening this door in Givens, I think, is the best way to think
yeah.
about it. But I think it's less because of the among the states language and more about broadly defining what is commerce.
Uh-huh. And so my last question, I try and ask this question every time.
Okay.
But so it's, as my EP government class will hopefully use this as a resource before the exam, could you just summarize in a few sentences Givens versus Ogden and its importance?
Sure. So I've already kind of given you the summary of the dispute, right? You've got these two gentlemen, they've got dueling licenses. One comes from a state, the other comes from the federal government. And they each want to operate a steamboat on the same basic water path, right? A ferry way, I don't know what you call that, along the water, right? Route. They want to operate the same route. And ultimately, New York seizes Gibbons' boat and says, you don't have the proper license. Gibbons says, yes, I do. Mine's federal. And so ultimately, he sues Ogden. He's not suing Ogden per se as an individual, but he wants his boat back, and he wants the right to continue to operate the steamboat. And so at issue there is the federal law that allows Congress to issue these coasting licenses, to navigate the waters along the coast of the United States. And ultimately, what the court says in this case is that Ogden and Gibbons are engaging in commerce, and that when commercial activity takes place solely within a state, intrastate commerce, then the state has the right to regulate it. Uh-huh. But when commerce or commercial activities are taking place that cross state lines, then Congress has the right to regulate it as interstate commerce.
Yeah.
So the key takeaway is that distinction between interstate commerce, or commercial activity that's taking place across state lines, and intrastate commerce, which is commercial activity taking place solely within state lines. And the upshot here, of course, is that the Marshall Court unanimously decides that the federal government should have the ultimate authority when it comes to interstate commerce, but states control their own intrastate activities.
Now, this brings us to the end of the third episode of Case Dismissed, A Teenager's Guide to the Supreme Court. I hope you now, after my very productive discussion with Dr. Bell, have a good understanding of the landmark Commerce Clause Supreme Court case and recognize the reaching effects of Gibbons versus Ogden and the grasp of what Congress and the court consider as commerce. Just think about it. Is the device you're listening on right now interstate commerce? What do you think?